Hello and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast recorded in the place of land. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
I'm Todd.
And we are on the unnamed world of the Sever-Team, encountering the face of evil.
So we've been off for 6 weeks.
We have. The Doctor's been travelling around by himself. He's not met Sharon from Black Castle yet.
I don't know what that is.
He also hasn't gone back to pick up Sarah Jane, rather inexplicably.
But you see, this is the 6 weeks of mourning that we need to get over Sarah Jane.
Yeah, I think that's right. And also to get over the fact that we don't have Engen.
Yeah, kinda why didn't he travel with the Doctor?
Oh, and while we're at it, why don't we throw in Professor Rumford as well?
That'd be awesome. In a heartbeat.
But you know what I love? I love that the first shot is, in fact, the new girl.
Yeah. I mean, we're continuing a tradition here, which Barry Letts started with Terror of the Autons, in that even though we're familiar with the character of the Doctor, the meeting between the Doctor and the Companion is really focused on the Companion and their life. And of course, here, it's taken to another level, because as you say, Todd, what we get before we even see the Doctor is a lot of backstory with Leela. So we know that she doesn't get along with the hierarchy in her tribe, and we hear something horrible happen to her father, and she is willing to sacrifice. No, we don't.
Oh, we hear it. We see him go and do it. But it's important. She's being exiled from her tribe for blasphemy. She's an atheist. She doesn't believe in God.
And not only that, but immediately we have a connection between her and the Doctor, because of course the Doctor left Time Lord Society because he didn't agree with the way they conducted themselves, and that's why Leela is being forced out of her society as well. Mm. You know, so it's a subtle connection, but I think it's quite powerful. Quite a few firsts in the story. So we got the first script by Chris Boucher, first story where Matt Irvine was in charge of the visual effects. He had previously just been an assistant. First story for Pennant Roberts as director. And first story for the aforementioned Leela, played by the fabulous, wonderful Louise Jameson.
She is terrific, isn't she?
Yeah, right from the start.
Right from the get-go, she has that physical presence, the drawing of the knife that Leela has, just that physicality. Mm. And I think it's so easy to forget when you look at this story and the two after it. Just, like, she's just there, boom.
Yeah.
She just is. It doesn't take a few stories to warm up or to evolve. Her speech patterns in the Sever-Team, just the way in which she phrases things. There are a few times where she'll say the odd line, I think, in this story where she sounds like BBC English.
You see, I love that, actually.
I'm not saying I don't. And she still does use that, right? But at times, my ears prick up at that point. I also think Louise just looks absolutely... She's so fit. And that costume... I mean, that's, you know, that iconic costume that she's in.
The terrible exploitative costume she wears.
Okay,
yeah,
that's
I'm going to come back to that in a moment.
But it is, you know, I'm glad that she has that costume as the warrior, you know. I don't like the later one, that other horrible, which I think is much
more... The Fendar one?
Which is much more exploitative than this one, because there's no reason to go to that one
if you got the other one. Were you going to say, Brendan, that it's equal opportunity exploitation?
Well, everyone else is quite scantily clad as well. Hello, David Garfield.
Oh, who's that? Right. Thomas?
David Garfield is Neva.
Oh, yes.
Hello, Neva.
That is a he has a magnetic stare and performance that I remember as a kid. He's insane, but he's just mesmerising to watch.
Yeah.
But and my favourite character is Thomas.
Oh, yeah. Thomas is lovely.
I like Neva. He's terrific.
Well, yeah. Thomas is my favourite.
I mean, and the great...
Who's yours, dear? Who's yours?
The great thing about having Thomas in there is the show has been so very sexless for most of its run. And when I say sexless, I'm talking about romance and sexual desire. Mm. You know?
What about Dodo?
We're not talking about the novels.
No, the elephant.
Of course, when Joe leaves, you know, she and Cliff, they're very intimate and very personal. Sarah never really gets any romantic overtures with any characters.
And no, she doesn't, does she? Joe does once a year, Sarah never does.
Joe quite often. Leela has this sort of romantic frisson with Thomas very early on. And unlike a lot of other romantic frissons, especially with Joe, Joe quite often wouldn't realise for a little while that the guy fancied her. And then she'd have to try and figure out a way to let him down gently.
Because she was always too fabulous for them, exactly. Essentially.
Whereas with Leela and Thomas, you get the impression that there is a mutual attraction there, but Leela doesn't want to endanger him with her exile, you know, but warns him, you know, be careful of Caleb. But then, on the other side of the program being sexless, because we have started doing Bondfinger now, bondfinger.com, check it out, I was just struck by the similarity between Leela and the Doctor meeting and Bond and Honey Rider. Because, of course, the shot of Honey Rider is designed to be sexual.
Can you explain that to viewers who may not have seen this shot?
Okay, so Honey Rider in Doctor No comes out of the sea. James Bond sees her. They talk. She's a bit scared of him at first, but begins to trust him, blah, blah, blah. Now, the same thing happens, in a way, with Leela. She's running through the forest, falls down, and comes across the Doctor, and they're both quite startled by each other. But in this, it takes out the element of sexual desire, obviously, because the Doctor doesn't do that with his companions. And to quote Richard for a second, that's why you don't snog them. But Honey Rider in Doctor No has a sort of childhood naivety, which you commented on at the time, Nathan. And Leela has that same naivety with the Doctor. Now, of course, the Doctor is a lot more respectful of that than James Bond is, because they're different characters. But that scene, even at this point, which is about 15 years since it was shot, that scene in Doctor No is so indelibly printed on film culture that I'm sure it was a conscious thing by Pennant Roberts to draw some visual parallels there. You know, right down to the fact that she knows the lay of the land and the Doctor doesn't. So straight away, we have a companion who, as well as being brave, as well as being independent, has unique skills and talents to offer to the Doctor. And
she's really
smart.
All
in the first 10 minutes.
She is really smart. Mm. And it's something that Chris Boucher gets right and nearly no one else does. That Leela quickly understands the things that the Doctor explains. I mean, she knows how her world works, obviously.
Yeah.
And she comes up with clever things. She's the one who realises there's a hole through the time barrier for Zoannon to speak through. She understands that the sound of the gong is going to attract the phantom-y things. Mm-hmm. You know, she's smart. She gets things very quickly. And it's not going to last. And I don't think it outlasts Chris Boucher, actually.
We'll see as we go on.
Yeah, we'll look at it. But she's certainly just wonderfully well written here. And it is one of those things, you know, you get introduced with 8 episodes of just terribly well-written Chris Boucher dialogue and you're set. But if Pip and Jane Baker write your first 4 to 5 episodes, then
you've
you're
got
in terrible trouble.
Mm.
Yeah. I love Bonnie Langford and I love Mel.
She's wearing a lot of bronzer in certain shots.
She's orange all throughout the rest of the season.
Dear listener, if you check out the making of on the DVD, you'll see it could have been much worse.
Yeah, there's that terrible publicity shot of her in, like, virtual blackface, which is what they were considering.
And Louise Jameson is so wonderful because she says in the interview there, the first day where we had the shoot, I don't think the makeup girl got it quite right. Here's her reaction to these shots looking like, and this is also a quote from her, it looks like someone gave me a mud pack and then didn't get it all off.
There's a few things in this episode that I want to talk about. First of all, it's Tom arriving in the jungle and facing the camera and giving...
That's terrible, isn't it?
Dialogue to the camera, and it goes on, and it goes on, and it goes on. I'm going, this is just crummy.
It's really poorly directed.
Yeah, this is Philip Hinchcliffe saying, okay, Tom, you want to talk to yourself, this is what happens.
It's awful.
I really like the jungle set. I actually do, even with those funny pipe things coming down, you know.
Sort of corrugated pipe, aren't they?
Yeah.
Look, I think the sand on the floor of the studio is good and makes it, like, that lifts it a bit. Yeah. It's not quite as good as the Ealing set for Planet of Evil, but it's a lot better than the television centre set for Planet of Evil.
Yes.
We can split the difference.
Yes. And one thing that I just burst out laughing, and I always forget it, is Neva's dance around the Doctor, you know, the evil spirit, you know, and that, oh, it just cracks me up.
The Doctor has that line, no, you're obviously a person of very superior intellect.
Yeah.
If you keep shaking that thing at me, we're both going to be standing in a smoky hole in the ground while he is beaming while saying that.
Well, that is part of the big theme of the story, which is it is an anti-religious polemic, and we won't see the same sort of thing until Planet of Fire, I think, when it's toned down
absolutely.
Really massively. But you have God, and God is a malevolent figure here. In fact, you know, each tribe's God is the other one's evil one, in a sense.
Yeah.
And all of this stuff, like Neva gives a litany, which is readings and responses. It's like prayers in church. You know, he has various rituals, but his religion is a cargo cult. It's based on the misinterpretation of various technological devices that have been left behind by his ancestors, you know. And so he's got that fantastic glove hat, you know.
That is hilarious. It's so funny.
All of that, like, and he's wearing a spacesuit draped over his back and so on, you know. So he doesn't understand the past, and his litany is all this sort of distortion of, you know, historical events that he doesn't understand properly. And then when we meet the Tesh, they have their own religion, which is the same kind of thing. And here, God, it's, you know, it was originally going to be called The Day That God Went Mad, wasn't it? And it's God causing the conflict between the Sevatim and the Tesh. And the word Zoanon, it, I happen to know, comes from the Greek word, an ancient Greek word which means to carve, and it means like a carved wooden figure that's worshipped as a god, like an idol.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So like the carving in the rock faces, like echoing the presence. Mm-hmm.
That's not very well done, is it, that model? No. Oh, but it is.
I think it's as well done as they could make it.
Mm. It's a pretty striking cliffhanger, though.
Yes, absolutely.
It is. But this is something I find really hard to buy, that the Doctor doesn't remember this. And they try and place this in the timeline of the show, don't they?
I think it's in the novelisation. I think it's Terence Dix's novelisation, am I right?
Yes.
And Terence places it during Robot. And so the Doctor's still unstable from his regeneration. And he disappears. I don't think it's when Sarah's hammering on the door of the TARDIS or something. But sometime during Robot, he goes and meets the Mordi expedition. And that's when it happens. Because it couldn't have happened with Sarah there, because Sarah would have slapped him out of it.
And possibly they would have worshipped Sarah like we do. so therefore, I never quite bought that as a kid. Yeah. Right? It's one thing that I find a little bit ropey. And the fact that the Sevatim have had to have degenerated so much, you know, there's this huge divide between both of them. And it's now at this particular juncture that, you know, Zoanon's like completely losing it. I mean, there's that shot where the Doctor finds the electronic device in the sand and, like, you know, and Leela's there, and I kind of think, surely somebody else could have found that, you know?
That's right. All he does is move a leaf.
I know. It sort of leads to the less credibility of the village. And you only see part of the village, and, like, these young warriors are dying left, right and centre by Janus Thorns every 2 minutes in episode one. It's sort of like, can you afford to kill off these people and send this girl away? Like, how big is this village? Like, you know, I couldn't see it being several hundred people, because we never see that. So I think
Leela kills 3 people in episode one. Am I right?
There's at least 2, because I know there's at least 2.
So she crossbows one of the guys pursuing her.
Okay, so there's 3.
And then she stabs that one guy, and then she sticks a Janus Thorn in the other guy. So she kills 3 people in the village. And you're right, it's only... And they must know them all, do you know what I mean? Like, she must kill the guy who, you know, used to, I don't know, sell meat or, you know, deliver the paper or something.
And it's this thing again in the season where we're given scripts where it's like this room or this part of the village. It's not... You're not seeing the whole thing because of budget limitations or whatever. So I don't quite buy it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is one of the aspects of this story that for me is a bit of a letdown. I like the first 2 episodes. There's a humorous sequence with when the Doctor's been harassed with the, what are they called?
Those the Vorta.
The Vorta, and then that one guy from the village is giving his hell, and he flicks that thing and it ends up on his arm and he goes screaming off into the jungle. I just burst out laughing.
The Doctor's really horribly violent in this as well.
Yeah. I mean, of course, Tom himself was not too happy at the moment because he didn't want another companion. He certainly didn't want a companion who drew the viewer's eye in the frame away from him. That was his reason for disliking Leela's costume. He didn't like the way it drew the viewer's eye within the frame.
Yeah.
But all credit to Louise Jameson, because she's had to come in as this character and Tom's not wanting a bar of it, yeah. You know? And for that not to appear on screen...
It eventually does appear on screen.
Yes, it does. There is a sequence later on, I think, in this story where he says something to Leela and the look that Louise Jameson, Leela Gibbs, gives him, it's like, that ain't acting. That is real.
You do see that from time to time, too. Yeah. And he'll refuse to speak to her or make eye contact with her and stuff.
I actually think, and I'm watching slightly ahead, I actually think the Doctor's treatment of Leela over the time in the show is pretty horrendous. It's actually, he actually tells her to shut up and all these things all the way through. And I actually think up to this, we don't see it yet, and I'm sort of jumping a bit ahead. Mm. I just feel that it's possibly the worst treatment of a companion up to this point. Like, I can't project
Dodo.
But I'm getting sidetracked here.
The doctor didn't dislike Dodo.
He treads on her lines. It's not just the worst treatment of a companion, but it's the worst treatment of a regular cast member, because Tom repeatedly treads on Louise's lines and stuff as well. Like, he's really, you know, he hasn't been in the show for that long, and he's really petulant and demanding and ungenerous already, I think.
The end of this episode, episode 2, I think it's Tomas is in peril.
Yeah.
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 So it's interesting to have not the companion in peril.
But it's also the fact that the monsters have taken the form of the Doctor's face.
Yeah, of course.
Which, we haven't really touched on this, but I find it really odd because in the massacre, we had essentially evil William Hartnell. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Hartnell wanted there to be another evil version of the Doctor, the son of Doctor Who, played by William Hartnell.
Oh, thank God that didn't happen.
we had Salamander, of course. We've had Android Doctor Who. We've had two Android Doctor Whos, actually.
Why didn't we get Evil Pertwee? That's what I would have loved to see Evil Pertwee.
See, I would have thought, Nathan, you would have said we did have Evil Pertwee.
You know, season seven.
Yeah. Well, no, Joe sandwiches, need I say more.
But yeah, that's what I'm thinking. We, you know, this is our second Evil Tom in 3 years.
Mm. Well, no Evil Pertwee.
No Evil Pertwee.
That seems unfair.
That being said, I think this is a far better Evil Tom, and we'll get arguably two more Evil Toms before Tom is finished. But
I can think of one.
Yes, exactly. Moving on. I think Tom's performance as Zoannan is really, really good. It has to be limited both in the fact that it's a voice, and of course Zoannan's a bit mad. And it's always a bit hard to play a mad character. It's like, do you go completely zany? Do you go just a little bit unhinged? And he just goes a little bit unhinged. And that wonderful bit where the Doctor's put Neva to sleep... and thankfully, you know, he stops Leela clobbering him and just puts him to sleep. But he has the conversation with Zoannan and starts getting scared.
Tom is spectacular, he's really good as the Doctor in that scene. He's wonderful.
You, me, us, we. And then we go inside the city of the Tesh.
Gosh, the Tesh are crummy, aren't they? So, the idea that we eventually learn that what's happening here is that Zoannan, who's essentially God, has pit these two groups of people against one another because he's crazy. Mm. And he wants to externalize his suffering and make everyone suffer. And it's a very negative polemic against religion, as I said before. Mm. But he's been telling himself, Zoannan's been telling himself, that it's a eugenics thing, that he's trying to breed the best kind of people of, you know, like strength and courage. I once said, how are the Tesh breeding?
There's no women. There's no women. We only see Leela, and then Pocahontas runs through at some point, right? and that's it. And the Tesh, I mean, what the hell are they wearing? Those shoulder pads, the helmets, terrible, like turquoise and magenta.
And they're just nappies, aren't they, the pants? I mean, they're really, really terrible. And they've got sort of yellow... You know, they've got yellow makeup and the curtsy bowing.
The curtsy bowing.
Todd's doing it now. Oh, it's terrible.
Not just now. That's actually how he says hello. thing is, I quite like their performances because I like the sort of fey, useless gentility of them. Because, you know, they're all perfectly nice and pleasant, and now we're going to dissect you with a laser.
With a freaking laser.
We get a bit of a stupid Doctor Who capture and escape. It's not even a cliffhanger when they destroy the laser with a handheld mirror.
Where does the laser come from?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, he's just had it up his sleeve. And even if he's got it up his sleeve, that's not where the laser's going.
The laser could be going in the other direction. Yeah, if they had been going in that direction, right. They'd be gone.
Yes.
Like, it'd be over.
Well, Leela would be gone. Well,
that's right.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we get into part four.
Wait a sec. Can I just mention that Leela shaves her armpits?
Well,
she's a very
maybe,
modern woman.
Very modern tribeswoman.
Maybe that's part of the eugenics experiment.
They've bred out armpit hair.
They may have bred out female body hair. They haven't bred out male body hair. We can see that. I like this story.
Sorry,
dear
listener.
No.
That is a terrible.
But we're sort of digression. Trying to move past, you know, into part four. There's a Teshu Cowers who looks like one of the McGann brothers.
Oh, the one who cowers in the corridor and the lights are going off and...
Yeah.
Yeah, it sort of explains...
Pathetic collapse. Pathetic collapse.
Does he sort of lower himself gently to the ground?
Oh,
I love that.
It's just not good.
Do you remember the electrified walls? I remember the electrified walls and being terrified of those as a child. Mm. And, of course, the Doctor kills someone by kicking that guy into the electrified wall because he gets possessed by Zoannon and tries to attack him.
One of the things I always remember about the story was those walls with the little cubes all the way up.
They look like chocolate.
But the fact that it was like a triangular set that they just seem to be going around the same set and then Neva gets in there with the guns. I always remember the guns with the big...
Those guns are superb, aren't they? That's a great great prop.
But I always thought it was really ropey that we suddenly went up into the Doctor's face and then there was that bit of effect where they walked through the wall and then there's a voiceover to explain how they get from there to the rocket.
It is very odd when everything else has been so visual and had such strong visuals and design. It is odd that, yeah, that's all done with voice. They don't even put a graphic on. Like, they could put a little light, like in The Time Warrior, where there's a light on a tennis pole.
but just something. It's just like, oh, we need to get from A to B. We're just going to say it, boom, go. Mm. But then the 17, they just get in there. They just, boom, they're suddenly there. There's no scene to see them discovering that. And it's just a few little plot things like that, and the Tesh that make this story sort of, after the first two episodes, which I really love, just go downhill for the last two.
But I just realised we could have had a whole scene with the Sever-team riding a tram for the first time.
That would have been cool.
That would have been great. We have, however, glossed over the episode 3 cliffhanger.
Which is spectacularly
which we should come back
good.
To. Yep. So we've got, I believe it's Tom, of course,
yes.
Greg DePaulnay and Pamela
Salem,
who are in the next story, but they came back... They came back to reloop this, and young Anthony Freeze.
Who won a competition.
Well, funny you should say that, because as he recalls it, Pennant Roberts' wife was a teacher at his school, and they wanted a child to voice that cliffhanger, because, of course, we're genetically coded in such a way that children screaming is distressing to us. Science has actually proven that, you know, we're socially coded, and it's in our DNA as well. So, yeah, he was brought in and he recorded it once in a recording session as a pre-thing and they were going to play it in. And then, for whatever reason, it didn't work out. So he came to the set and Pamela Salem and Greg DePaulnay were there as well and they had to record it again. And he's interviewed on the DVD and he's just like, it was amazing. You know, I was on set with Tom Baker and he gave me a poster to Anthony, a great day's work from The Doctor, 1876. But, yeah, first of all, it's effective because it's Tom sort of collapsing to his knees. And, you know, you think of his Doctor as being this very upright figure who doesn't get overpowered. But as we've discovered, he's getting overpowered quite often in these first few years. You know, Steyer knocks him down. He's chained to the table by Stigran. Morbius knocks him out and he needs Elixir. So it's not that uncommon.
Sutek makes him kneel
Sutek
before
makes him
the
kneel.
Might of Sutek.
But also... We've had all these Doctor Who villains and monsters who, even when they are sort of determined, the Doctor tries to reason with them and they do reason back with him and it's a discussion. There is no reasoning with Zoannon because Zoannon, first of all, won't accept the Doctor's identity. Just no. And then start screaming, who am I? It's so effective because it's such a different enemy and it's such a different villain in that, you know, it's the Doctor. And then it's a child screaming it. And when the child starts screaming, all the other voices disappear, all the other sound disappears, and you just have the child shouting, who am I, who am I, who am I, and then the credits kick in. It's so well done.
You've got the visuals too, where you've got those three screens, you know, with the projected pictures like of Tom's face, and you actually see Tom saying who am I when the child's saying it, and it's really fabulously visual and hugely exciting. And you know, it'll be recycled later in Blake 7 for Dawn of the Gods, Harvest of the Gods, Dawn of Kairos, one of those. In fact, this whole setting, Chris Boucher completely reuses over and over again in Blake 7. You know,
he's the new Terry Nation.
He really is. But it all starts here. This is the Blake 7 years of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
It's interesting at the end of this story that the Doctor's been lying around for 2 days when he wakes
up.
I think that's quite fun. And the Doctor leaves them bickering.
I actually really like the bit too that Leela's talking to him about the situation between the Tesh and the Sevateen, and you know how they've not been getting on and they have an uneasy truce. And then we get to see it. But like the idea that the Doctor's been out cold for 2 days while those guys have been wrangling. You know, and we're going to leave it behind as it's kind of going to be the worst odd couple kind of odd couple in space. Sort of premise for a sitcom sometime in the future. And Leela narrowly misses out on the opportunity to be in charge of it. There is one scene that I want to mention because Douglas Adams rips it off shamelessly in Life, the Universe and Everything. And that's the scene once Zoanon's been healed, which unfortunately the Doctor just does by pressing some buttons on a thing, which is all very dull. But Zoanon's been healed and the Doctor and Leela go to visit Zoanon and they chat and Zoanon's really nice and rational.
Got a little chaise lounge and a gramophone.
But that's it. The couch appears, right? And they sit on it. And then for a second it looks like Zoanon's going to be psychoanalyzed because he says, you know, where do you think I first went wrong? And the Doctor realizes he's sitting on this couch and we've got a therapy session in progress. But Douglas Adams uses it in Life, the Universe and Everything because remember that there's a supercomputer orbiting around the planet Cricket, which influences the society of the cricketers so that they become, you know, sort of xenophobic, homicidal maniacs because of his own sort of personality thing. And Hakdar is the name of the computer, and he's eventually restored. And Trillian and Arthur meet him in this void where they have a pleasant conversation and a Chesterfield sofa appears and you know, they sit and chat with him. So Douglas has ripped off Doctor Who before, obviously, but this is a pretty obvious one here.
Yes, yes.
At the end of the episode, I believe there were two different endings filmed, one where Leela goes with, one where she doesn't. But it's really interesting that she actually asked the Doctor to be taken with him. And in the new series, if you ask for that privilege, you end up dying.
Yes. Also,
or you get a hole in your head.
Of course.
Yes. I mentioned earlier that Leela being cast out gives her an immediate synergy with the Doctor, if you like. Mm. The end of this is it's the same kind of thing as the ending of The Deadly Assassin, because of course the ending of The Deadly Assassin, the Doctor's been elected as president and slips away quietly. The ending of this, the Tesh and the Sevateen both say to Leela, oh, you should lead us, you know, we both trust you. And she says, no, I'm far too unreasonable, don't you agree, Doctor? And she runs after him to avoid becoming the leader of the planet, you know. Like
it
the
would
Doctor,
be a pretty thankless task.
Yeah, exactly.
It?
But like the Doctor, she runs away from the enforced responsibility in order to make her own choice. And, you know, even the Doctor, you know, rejects her because, much like Tom, the Doctor doesn't want to travel with anyone right now. And then she goes inside and you get that great bit of, don't touch that! You know, it's
the helmet regulator again.
Yeah, it's stupid Scooby-Doo ending comedy. But it's sold by the fact that she sort of skips in naughtily and the Doctor's like, come out of there. Come out. And again, that's kind of Bond and Honey Rider once again. But without the sex, because No hanky-panky in the TARDIS.
Thank God. Well, I have to say that I expected to like this a lot less than I did. And I think that there are production flaws that we've all identified. But for me, this has some real proper science fiction in it for a change.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Some really thoughtful ideas and a little bit of sort of thematic content, which is reasonably interesting. There are some great performances, and it really does introduce a pretty spectacular new companion. So I think it's a net win.
Yeah.
Look, I think it's a net win. I like the performances. I do think it goes downhill once we hit the Tesh, and I'm less engrossed with that part of the story. I know you two have praised all the Zoan and stuff. Some of that leaves me a bit cold. I think it's a better script than the previous two, but it's my second least favourite of the season. So,
yeah. Just to close out, I mean, something we really criticised Deadly Assassin for last week was the level and tone of the violence in the show.
Yeah.
Now, this, I would say, is still very violent. You know, you've got gun battles, you've got stabbings, you've got Janus Thorns, you've got crossbows.
Leela kills five people. Three people in episode one, and she does kill two of the Tesh later on.
But the Doctor's not doing the killing.
Mm. And importantly...
He does kill that one guy.
Yeah.
And he throws a hoarder on the other guy.
Yeah. That's funny.
Importantly, the Doctor comments on the violence.
In this story. Okay.
And it's been a while since he's sort of commented on people's violent actions as strongly as he says to Leela, who gave you license to slaughter people?
Yeah, yeah.
Because when he kills that Tesh, the Tesh is trying to kill him.
Yes.
That's self-defense. But Leela, when she Janus Thorns Nova from Blake 7 and leaves him in the wall, that's just to block their exit. And I think that's the Doctor's objection. It's like, that
Nova
was unnecessary.
From Blake 7?
It's Nova from Blake 7.
Bless.
He never survives anything he's in.
Actually, he always ends up in a wall as well.
Even in Sapphire and Steel. Well, dear listener, that's all the time we have for The Face of Evil, but we'll be back next week as Doctor Who takes another upswing with the Robots of Death. I'm not going to say anything else about that right now, just because I think we're all going to have a lot to say about that.
Terrible.
Until then...
Oh, Nathan has been funny, listeners. Very, very funny indeed.
That's all right. We'll just replace him with James Selwood next week. Until then, please come and find us online at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, and FTE Podcast on Twitter. We currently have available on bondfinger.com commentaries for the first three Connery Bond films. So Dr. No, which we've discussed this episode, From Russia With Love, and Goldfinger. So those are on bondfinger.com, Bondfinger on Facebook and iTunes, and Bondfinger Cast on Twitter. Until then, thank you very much for listening, and good night.
Good night.
See you soon.
That was Flight Through Entirety with Todd Bielby, Nathan Bottomley and Brendan Jones. This episode, So Very Sexless, was recorded on Sunday, the 2nd of August. The next episode will be released on October the 11th, 2015. Who knew the legends of the Evil One were all just misunderstandings? Zoanna actually eats baby carrots.
I don't have a great opening line for Face of Evil, so does anyone have any suggestions?
Who am I?
No, so the only Doctor Who podcast...
Yeah.
That's all I've got.
Right.